Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Uprising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together. In other words, to address problems instead of defending positions. Well, with COVID-19 front and center in the news, and with talk of how quickly a vaccine can be developed and by whom, national and international attention is being focused on the pharmaceutical industry. So who better to have on Wiki Politiki Radio this week than the man who wrote the book, literally, on Big Pharma, investigative journalist Gerald Posner. He's the author of Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Gerald Posner was, at age 23, one of the youngest attorneys ever hired by the Wall Street law firm Kravitz, Swain, and Moore. He's a Phi Beta Kappa and summa cum laude graduate of University of California at Berkeley. He was an honors graduate of Hastings Law School, where he served as the associate editor for the Law Review. He was co-founder of Posner and Ferrara, a public interest law firm, where a pro bono legal representation on behalf of surviving twins of Nazi experiments at Auschwitz led him to co-author his first book in 1986, Mengele, The Complete Story, a best-selling and critically acclaimed biography of the infamous Angel of Death, Nazi Dr. Joseph Mengele. Gerald is also the author of Case Closed on the Kennedy assassination, Killing the Dream about the Martin Luther King assassination, and God's Bankers, which chronicles the history of money and power at the Vatican. He's been a freelance writer on investigative issues for several news magazines. He's a regular contributor to NBC, the History Channel, CNN, Fox News, CBS, and MSNBC. He lives in Miami Beach with his wife, author Tricia Posner, who works on all his projects with him. Well, welcome, Gerald.
Steve, fantastic to be with you. Thank you very much for letting me join you at this time.
Well, you know, I understand that your book, Pharma, took 5 years to write. What sparked your interest in writing the book in the first place?
Part of it is you can tell when you talk about other projects that I've taken on over time. I like taking on challenging projects about which I know very little, which is good. So it means I have to start from the ground up. There are a lot of those. And this had actually been planted in the back of my mind back in the late 90s. I was having a conversation with a journalist who was then in his 80s, James Phelan. He was one of America's great investigative journalists in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. He had unmasked the hoax of Clifford Irving writing the fake Howard Hughes biography and a whole bunch of other things. We shared the same editor at Random House. And in a conversation with him about the state of investigative journalism and how it was changing, he said he thought that books were really the only area in which you could really spend a lot of time and come up with a great story. And I said, you know, if you had your choice, what would you do? He said, if, you know, I was 20 years younger, I'd be doing the pharmaceutical industry. It's like throwing a dart at a dartboard. There's so much out there. And I thought, you know, I will put that back, and sometimes it takes a while. It took six books until I finally got here and found a publisher in Avid Reader Press, a new imprint from Simon & Schuster, that was willing to let me go out and see what I could find. And 5 years later, here I am with a book sort of on the history of the American pharmaceutical industry.
Well, you know, of course, the book is coming out at a time when just about everybody's aware of the opiate crisis. Perhaps it wasn't as big when you started the book. And a key portion of your book focuses on the Sackler family. They're behind the Purdue Pharma and, of course, OxyContin. Was this an initial focus of the book, or did it just emerge inside the process?
Yeah, it definitely emerged in the process. So, you know, I believe that anybody who has done a nonfiction book and tells you that their final manuscript matches the proposal that they sent into the publisher, something's wrong. Either they knew everything beforehand and didn't have to do any reporting or research, and so it's the same, or they didn't do any reporting and research, and it's the same. But once you get going on the reporting end, you become, you know, sometimes it's the wrong way it sounds. I say you become a victim of your sources, not a victim, but the people who agree to speak to you, the documents that you get, the materials that are provided to you, the freedom of information request where I request documents from the government, the files that I found, let's say, in the Senate files that hadn't been out before in the archives, the National Archives, they take you in new directions. And I always thought I'd have a couple of chapters at least about the opioid crisis, the impact on people, and what had happened with the Sackler family. But you're absolutely right. I had no idea before I started that the Sacklers themselves were sort of the zealots of the pharmaceutical industry, went back to the 1940s. You know, they were involved in the 50s and changing the way the advertisement, the way they advertised pharmaceutical companies, advertised drugs. And in the 60s, they created they helped Valium become the first $100 million drug and then the first $1 billion drug. And they had their hands in lots of different things way before anyone ever heard about the word OxyContin. Even a Senate investigation said there's a Sackler empire and described dozens of companies that they had their hands in. You look at the date on the top and it's 1962, 44 years before OxyContin was ever developed. So that was the surprise. And they provide sort of a narrative thread through a lot of things in the book as we get up to finally the opioid crisis.
You know, it's very interesting. One of the things that you mentioned is that, you know, going back to the 1940s, the family was, or people in the family were quote unquote communists. So it's really interesting how communism segued into a kind of a predatory, predatory version of capitalism. How did that transition take place?
You know, so it's so interesting you mentioned that, because if somebody says to me sometimes, you know, like, what's the biggest surprise in the book? They're obviously looking for something to do with the pharmaceutical industry. One of the biggest personal surprises for Tricia and me was when we got the documents from the FBI that we had requested this Freedom of Information request and found out that the FBI had investigated the Sacklers for 20 years in the 50s and 60s, because the youngest brother of the three patriarchs, they were all psychiatrist brothers. You know, these are children of immigrant Polish and Russian, Eastern European Jewish immigrants who came to New York at the beginning of the 1900s and ran a grocery store. The three sons were the first children to ever go to college. Two of the brothers had to go to Glasgow to Scotland for medical school because NYU had filled its quota for Jewish students that year. We forget that NYU used to have quotas for Jewish students and wouldn't let in more than a certain number. And they became psychiatrists. And what's fascinating is they had these hard left convictions. The youngest brother joined the Communist Party in America, which was right in the middle of the Cold War. His wife was a card-carrying member. The FBI is looking into the brothers, even in a possible espionage investigation. And Arthur, the patriarch of the family, the oldest brother, who's really the, sort of the leader of the group, he does some interesting things. In World War II, he's protesting the fact that the Red Cross is segregating blood by black and white. They know medically it's useless, but they were taking black blood and white blood and keeping them segregated. He was against that. He was using his advertising firms, which, you know, revolutionized the drug advertising business, not for the good necessarily, but he was using those firms as a safe haven for journalists fired from the New York Times and LA Times and other papers because they were called before Joe McCarthy's Red Scare Senate committee during the height of the Cold War. And when they refused to answer the question and invoke their Fifth Amendment rights as to whether they had or were members of the Communist Party, they got fired. And Sackler gave them safe haven. So I liked that part of him. But boy, you're absolutely right. By the time the brothers get into the 70s, 80s, and then by the time they get into OxyContin and the opioids, they have become full-fledged. They have given up on their sort of, egalitarian, socialist, left-wing roots, and they are full-fledged, full-throttled capitalists to the nth degree.
Now, you mentioned that they were also involved in advertising. Were they also involved in somehow, you know, when you and I were kids, there were no drugs advertised on media. There was Seretan, you know, nature
right.
spelled backwards.
That's right.
That was it. Did they have anything to do with this infusion of drug commercials over the last decade or two?
No, so it's very interesting. So, I have a chapter in there about direct-to-consumer advertising, and that really doesn't start until 1997 when it's opened up for the public, and it's fantastic. That's how we see these ads on television and everything else. You turn it on, you hear about some new drug that's supposed to cure this or that, and the next thing you know, you listen to the side effects, and you're horrified and think, why would I take that? The only time you don't have to, by the way, disclose any of the side effects is if you advertise something on television or radio or print, and you don't describe what the drug is for. And so you think, why would anyone do that? But the first ad that was ever run was really for Claritin, which is for allergy medication. Mm-hmm. I remember it quite well. It was sort of a young couple running through a field filled with flowers and grass and sort of this wonderful pastoral scene. If you look at the commercial, you first think it could be for an antidepressant or that. They seem so happy. It turns out it's actually for an allergy medication, but they tried that. And the only other one that really did it was Nexium with the little purple pill. They just kept saying, the little purple pill, ask your doctor, and people did and then found out it was for heartburn. But the Sacklers, what you say for them, what they did in revolutionizing advertising is they went into a business that was a lazy business that had come out of World War II, and what they would do, the traditional pharma firms sent to doctors, because doctors are the middlemen who have to prescribe, and dispense to us, the patients, the drug, or we can't get it. So they would advertise to them by sending them essentially the insert that the FDA approved. And Sackler thought, boy, this is like, it belongs in the 1900s. This is pretty boring. So he got them to send free samples. His first client was really Pfizer with an antibiotic. He made it the biggest selling antibiotic in the country. He sent free samples to doctors. He got them to make detail men, which they were all men then, the sales forces that went out and did the personal pitch. He came up with the idea of what I call, Steve, pharmaceutical swag, gifts that would be given to them. Send them to Bermuda in the middle of the winter if they were New York doctors for a conference. Put them on the Speaker's Bureau. And he put advertising on steroids to the doctors. He made JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, sort of, 70% ads and brought in a bundle of business to them. So it was a much more aggressive form of doing it. And then Sackler was the one who, with a partner, started a firm that started to collect data on the way doctors prescribe. So he was able, in the future, to tell firms, you know what, these 10 doctors here in Manhattan – or these 7 doctors in San Francisco, they are writing 20% of all the prescriptions for this mild tranquilizer. You have a new drug like Valium, go to them first because they're going to be the ones you have to convert. He knew how to target it. And in that way, he helped build up their sales to big numbers.
Well, it's interesting. It's marketing. That's what marketing is about.
Yep.
You find your prime customers and you do that. And you just have to wonder at what point did did it simply become a pathology in a certain regard?
Yep.
Because all of a sudden you're presenting these drugs to doctors, giving them free samples, and then we now probably 40 years later or 50 years later, we're seeing the huge issue of over-prescription.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the over-prescription of all kinds of medications, how did that come about?
Wow, you hit on such a key issue. So there are a few things in here. First of all, there's an element to which, and I write about this in the book, it's so interesting, in which Sackler figured out, and the pharmaceutical companies that weren't his clients then copied this style, which is you needed to get it widely prescribed. So what you had is he was looking for a lifestyle drug in the late 1950s, early 60s, something that would almost be like a be happy pill. You wouldn't have to be sick to take it. So the first lifestyle drug, something that was approved by the FDA that you didn't have to be sick to take, but was the oral contraceptive. It gave women the right to control their own reproductive rights. And then so Sackler was looking for that. And the closest thing he could find really was Valium and Librium, both by the same company, Hoffmann-La Roche. So his idea was that you had to market that to general practitioners. They existed back then, as you know, so not everybody was a specialist. And you wanted them to write the prescriptions, not the psychiatrists, not the people who are specializing in mental health or that. And so he made it a general pitch. You know, they use these experiments to say in these stereotypes for men and women. Men were the breadwinners. They're going out. They're earning the money. They're bringing home for the family, and they have to look tough to the rest of the world. They get ulcers, so we should prescribe it to them so they don't get ulcers. Women, they're neurotic and hysterical, and therefore we need to prescribe it to them so they can do more housework. I mean, you know, it's terrible stuff. But there are Adderall ads, literally, in which you see a woman doing more house cleaning with a vacuum cleaner, and that it would be laughable if it weren't true. And they and so what he found, and the drug companies found, is that nearly 90% of the prescriptions for those psychoactive drugs that were coming out and drugs that were really later for depression and that were being written by doctors without a specialty in it, just being dispensed because they thought of it as a feel-good pill. And I think that that was the start of what I call an overprescription in many areas, plus the fact that disease items were medicalized over time. So panic disorders in 1980 suddenly became a medical condition officially in the diagnostic of, you know, the DSM, the psychiatric Bible. That meant it was covered by insurance so people could write for it. Social anxiety disease, anxiety itself, PTSD. Once they become medicalized as conditions, then they're covered by insurance. Then pharmaceutical companies push the doctors to write more scripts, and they do, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Wow. Well, we're going to take a very short break. We'll be back with Gerald Pauser and talk more about pharma and some of the intriguing things he found out in writing his book. This is Steve Behrman. We're on WikiPolitiki Radio.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay.
911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, hi, this is Steve Behrman. We're back with our guest, Gerald Pauser, on WikiPolitiki. We're talking about the pharmaceutical industry. And fascinating. It's just I don't even know which thread to pick up first. But I think I want to go backward in history because, again, your book is a balanced account of the pharmaceutical industry. So, you know, before we – I know we've gotten into some of these darker areas. What about some of the triumphs and high points in the pharmaceutical industry that you uncovered in your book?
I'm glad you mentioned that as a lead into that. I had a discussion with my publisher because the subtitle of the book had been for a while Pills, Profits, and Pandemics. It changed at the last minute, and the publisher put a subtitle in that said Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. And I said, but that doesn't – it just sounds like it's all negative. And I did try to actually balance it out because there are some inspirational stories, but the subtitle doesn't necessarily reflect that. Some of the best – I mean, they have created, meaning the drug companies in general, I use that as a big broad brush – some of the things that allow us to live as long as we do. None better than probably penicillin in World War II, one of the greatest human discoveries ever, the first time we actually have something, an antibiotic, to fight the infections that used to kill people, the blood poisonings and everything else, and the bacterial infections that, you know, savaged generations for 2,000 years. So the penicillin was a game changer, as was the polio vaccine in the 1950s. And as you know, there's a chapter titled, Can You Pass in the Sun? Because Jonas Salk, the inventor of one of the polio vaccines, was asked if he would have a patent to own the rights and make money from the vaccine, or should a drug company. And he said, no one should. He said, you know, can you patent the sun? Now, that was a wonderful view of how vaccines for the public should be used in a general sense. Not all companies have kept that in later years. And there are other instances in here. I think you see them as well, Stephen, which even Merck was run by a doctor for a while in the 70s and 80s, Roy Vagelos. And he gave away a drug for river blindness that they had developed in the third world where it was needed because they knew nobody in those governments was going to be able to afford it. And literally it cost them tens of millions of dollars, but it's something that's not done very often. So there are some great little stories here of dedicated scientists inside the labs looking for cures and trying to come up with them. And they are overwhelmed at times, or overshadowed, I should say, by the greed in the executive boardrooms occasionally, and by the last somber mark that we've been left, the sour taste of the opioid crisis.
Let's talk a little bit about the opioid crisis. When would you say that actually, quote unquote, began? What was like the first indicator that this was going to become overwhelming to the point where there's people living in the streets because of it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's a hackneyed expression to say that, hindsight's 20/20 or a Monday morning quarterbacking, but it's hackneyed and said so often because it's true. Now we look back and you can see through that prism. Oh, you think, my goodness, it's why writers like me who are doing histories always look so clever, because the line seems so clear. And you think, why weren't people stopping it here? It wasn't really until, I would say, the early 2000s, 2001, 2002, that there was the first signs. New York Times doing front page newspapers, articles being written in LA Times and other stories, some news coverage, and that there was a sign that there was a abuse in some areas, pill mills, doctors writing too many prescriptions in Kentucky, West Virginia, hardworking blue-collar areas for opioids, particularly OxyContin, this delayed-release version put out by Purdue Pharma. And I received a packet, as I described in the book, a manila envelope with just a return address from New York. I don't know who it was sent from this day in the last year of my research, and it turns out those were files about a fight between the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the FDA, which regulates drugs. Those two agencies were at war with each other in 2002, an amazing bureaucratic battle behind the scenes. The DEA thought that OxyContin was being diverted to the street and there were a lot of abuses and was killing people. The FDA said, no, don't worry, we regulate it, we know what's going on, and they didn't do anything. And that was a point where we could have slowed it up, but I don't think it was any bad intent or will on the FDA's part. They just were not willing to take it on. And in 2007, Purdue Pharma pleaded guilty as a corporation to misbranding the drug and over, making it too easy to get. They paid a $600 million fine, and three of its executives paid a big fine. That should have been the end of it. Went on for another 12 years, as we're talking here in 2020. So there are a lot of people to blame. The drug companies who aggressively marketed, and those include Johnson & Johnson, Endo, and others, they all had opioid products. It includes the doctors who overwrote the prescriptions, wrote too many, and operated like as legalized drug dealers. It includes the FDA that was a bit too compliant and not willing to crack down earlier. I have sort of an equal opportunity castigator. I point fingers around the board. It's not just one person. There are some more to blame than others. And there were doctors who were leading a movement that said, by the way, we should treat pain first and opioids aren't as addictive, which fed into it all. So it's like the perfect storm.
You know, you mentioned the Sackler, the Sacklers early on, and that they were the ones that got the general practitioners to begin prescribing these things as kind of, as you say, a feel-good drug rather than something that is used to treat a medical condition. And, of course, they created medical conditions so that they could have drugs to treat it, you know, and that, yeah. And all of that. And that brings me to the next question. Ever since the coming of capitalism's Lord and Savior, Milton Friedman, the bottom line has become the only line, or as my Swami character says, the rule of gold has overruled the golden rule. Yeah, I mean, sometimes the truth isn't that comedy isn't that funny anymore.
Yeah, you're
it's also true. You're laughing because it's not funny.
That's right.
but how? I know, of course, we've been a capitalist country, since the outset. But what has happened over our lifetime, certainly over the last 25 or 30 or 40 years, that has made the pursuit of profit so? Such a powerful force that there doesn't seem to be any kind of balance of decency to balance that out. And particularly in dealing with health, which is not like, going to the store and buying clothes or going and getting entertainment. It's a fundamental necessity like food.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. No, because I do think that when we're talking about the pharmaceutical industry, it's not like we're talking about a company that's making $1 billion by selling tires, or they're coming out with electric cars as Tesla is, or something like that. And I don't mean to diminish those industries, but this is something that affects all of us in a different way. It is the healthcare system. It is drugs. We're all paying for it one way or the other. I write about this in a chapter called The One Atom Difference. It's about in the 1950s, George Merck, sort of the great-great-grandson of the original founders of Merck, he believed that the drug companies were almost a quasi-public trust. And he gave this address to a graduating class of the Medical School of Virginia. And he said, we try to remember that medicine is for the patient. We never can forget that. I have this quote embedded in my mind. He said, it's not for the profits. The profits will follow. And if we remember that, they have never failed to appear. The better we remember it, the larger they have been. Now, that was an interesting idea. But Arthur Sackler and Jack McKean, who then ran Pfizer, and the other people who were the new generation coming up in the pharmaceutical business, viewed him as an old fuddy-duddy, some guy who was another generation. Look at that guy over there at Merck talking about a quasi-public trust, and we focus on medicine first. The new generation of people who were in the business then, including the fellow who was running Pfizer, who picked Sackler for his ad campaign, said, good sales can sell even a mediocre drug. And the reason that chapter is called The One Atom Difference, the drug that Sackler made a bestseller, the top-selling drug in America for Pfizer, was an antibiotic called terramycin. It had one atom of difference from a previous patented drug by a competitor. Letterlay had a drug out called Aeromycin. They had no therapeutic difference. There was virtually nothing. They were able, the Pfizer attorneys, to get that through the patent office. And once they did, Sackler was able to sell it to doctors as being better, and doctors were able to prescribe it to people in enormous numbers, and it started to be about money. And I think that this focus on the bottom line has time and time again come back to hurt the industry, hurt us as patients, and that's one of the reasons the pharmaceutical industry ranks somewhere between, I don't know, used car salesmen and Congress in a public opinion poll. And Steve, I think that one of the things here is, you know, we've seen these instances. We are the only country in the world, by the way, America, the only country that allows drug companies unfettered power to set their own prices. It's amazing. In every other country, there's some form of negotiations, price controls, whatever. Here, they say it's $500,000 for a drug, $2,000 for a drug, whatever. Insurance companies may not cover it, but they set the price. And that's why we pay, on average, 2 to 4 times the cost for the very same drug as the closest competing nation. And to me, that's ridiculous after all these years.
You know, one of the reasons why I've launched this Wiki Politiki Radio and seriously bringing left and right front and center is because we've been divided into these two political tribes that spend all their time arguing about identity issues when it's the identical issues like clean air, clean food, clean water, clean government, and you know, being able to actually live a life as a quote-unquote middle-class individual, that's really been taken away from us. And because of all of these wedge issues that the two parties get involved with, we haven't been able to speak in one voice to go, wait a minute, we, the people of this country, we're tired of this, and most of us are very tired of it. So,
what you're saying, I know that I've seen that as the, you know, one of your themes and underlying principles of the show, and I think it's so important because people will sometimes say to me, okay, so who's to blame? Republicans or Democrats? And I say, oh, that's simple. Both sides of the aisle. I mean, I can give you a decade in which Republicans were worse at this. I can give you a decade in which Democrats were worse. But it's not a conservative or liberal issue. It's not a Democratic or Republican issue because it becomes a money issue in the end. And the best example of this is just a couple of weeks ago, Congress passed an $8.3 billion emergency funding bill, the first of the big money bills, $3 billion in there for the drug industry to try to rush a vaccine forward. Now, everybody wants the drugs now. I understand that. That should be the top priority, no question. But I'm keeping a magnifying glass on the pharma industry because that's the subject I've written about. And what was very interesting is in the first draft of that bill, I mean, they were rushing it through in days, it gave the federal government the right to go in if they thought the final price of the vaccine by the company that discovered it was too high. They had some real teeth to be able to bring that price down. The second part was that the research for the vaccine would be shared by all the companies. No one would own the proprietary rights, the intellectual property rights. Both of those clauses came out in the final bill that was passed. So it gives pharma a little bit more leeway. And what's interesting is we have a Senate controlled by the Republicans and a House controlled by the Democrats. Both of them passed it. Both parties had to be on board on that. So my point is this isn't about, you know, which tribe you're in. The tribe is we are people. We are patients. We are the ones who actually say to both sides of the aisle, we really need you to do more protecting us than worrying about the industry. The industry is going to do fine on its own. It's going to make a profit all the time.
Yes, and I just I saw a recent quote in one of your interviews recently. You're quoted as saying pharmaceutical companies view COVID-19 as a once-in-a-lifetime business opportunity. So let's begin that conversation. Given the current new word situation that we have out there, everybody knows what that word means for some reason. It doesn't need a dictionary definition. How do you see that playing out at this moment? I mean, you already offered a sad example, but tell us more about that.
So, you know, the second to last chapter in this book is titled The Coming Pandemic, and it ends with an infectious disease specialist telling Tricia and me in an interview in 2016, when it comes to the next pandemic, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And so although coronavirus, COVID-19, is not mentioned in the book because my book was sitting at the printer getting ready for its publication when China reported the first two deaths from Wuhan from a strange new disease, as you know, I look at pandemics and histories of pandemics and how the U.S. has responded to them over time. And when I say the pharmaceutical industry views it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for profits, that's a cold calculus. It sounds – yeah, it's very cold to say, but the history of the pharmaceutical industry – shows us that time and time again. And the most recent example for anybody who doubts it is in the 1980s with HIV and AIDS. When it took a researcher at the National Institutes of Health, which is the government-sponsored research institution, taxpayer money. That researcher said when they were looking for the first drug to try to treat HIV, I think an antiviral that is sitting over at Burroughs, their drug company, might be able to do something in the lab. It has all the features that could work. But Burroughs had a patent on that drug. So the government researchers went to Burroughs and said, could we have some of the compound of that drug to test in our labs at our expense, our cost? Burroughs said, okay. Burroughs did not use the drug. They had a patent. It wasn't used because it was so toxic in their own testing. They couldn't even make the drug, Steve, in their own lab because they hadn't made it in so long. So the NIH had to provide the DNA strand that allowed them to make the compound. Burroughs then gives it to the NIH, who does all the testing for the next year, in addition to some academics and private money out in San Francisco. They come up with the drug AZT, which was the first drug to treat HIV and AIDS patients. And at that point, Burroughs says, okay, we own it. We want the patent. And the NIH said, no, it's our effort. We put it together. You only supplied some of the compound after we helped you. They went to court. Burroughs won. They put out AZT under their own patent. They charged $10,000 a patient. That was at that time the most expensive drug in history at that point. Now it's been surpassed many times over. Against the protests of ACT UP and other AIDS activists, they lowered the price to $8,000. Burroughs made billions in the first few years of sales on a drug to treat AIDS at a time that people were dying that was all based upon government research. And to me, that shows you what's wrong with the system. If you ask me, why would drug companies today know that if they could cross the line first on a vaccine or the early treatments to treat COVID-19, based on the money that's flooding the system, public research, they stand to make a fortune? They all know that. And that's a shame because I don't mind them making a profit. We're a for-profit system. I understand that. But it goes back to what you were talking about before. If you come up with this vaccine, all the money's provided by the government. It costs you $10 a person. Charge $11. I'm just giving you an example. Don't charge $20. Don't gouge us. Everybody's suffering at this moment. We're all tightening our belts. You know, industries like airline industry and cruise industry and restaurants are upside down. People are out of work. The economy's in a sort of a tailspin. The drug companies have to make a sacrifice too. That's all. Make a profit. Just don't make so much that your CEOs can take $100 million and, you can buy back the shares of your company so your stock price is higher.
Well, it's created a lot of bitterness in this country. Government by the highest bidder has created bitterness. Right. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll be back with Gerald Posner and talk more about pharma. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Behrman, we're back with our guest, Gerald Posner. We're talking about pharma. You know, we've talked about a lot of problems, and I think a lot of people can relate to it. They're not surprised. They may be shocked. They may be disgusted, but not surprised. Well, let's talk about what can we possibly do about it. What have you come up with in the work that you've done? Do you see any positive directions where we the people can actually have some leverage in this situation?
You mean, Steve, I have to do more than just point out the problems? No, I do.
Fill many books. Right there.
Yeah, that's right. No. I do. As a matter of fact, some of the fixes are really pretty simple. They're not going to fix everything. But what I'm saying is, only when I got into this, and that's why it took so, I think 5 years. Do you see that where the holes are? Sometimes you need to fill in the gaps. I have a chapter on something called orphan drugs, which a lot of people think, well, what are those? And it's just a law that was created in the 1980s. To make sure drug companies didn't ignore people, small populations with genetic diseases, but they were so small, 10, 15, 20,000 people, the drug companies would say, there's not enough patients for us, we're not going to develop a drug for them. So the government gave all types of subsidies, tax credits, fast approvals, extended patents on these. And the drug companies over time have figured out how to game the system very, very well. They keep cutting the specifications for their drugs for children and then for people who are over this size and this size. So they keep getting these patents extended under special exclusions. It would be simple to go back to what the law was intended. It takes about two fixes in two sentences in Congress. Nobody has done it. Eight of the most expensive drugs in the world today are orphan drugs. Gilead, the other day, the drug company, when it first applied for approval for its fast testing on remdesivir, one of these products that may be good to treat COVID-19, tried to put it under an orphan classification. I talked to a reporter about that, and there were a lot of pickup on that around the world. Gilead backed off of that a couple of days later. So they have to keep an eye on pharma, and we can do that. Our people in Congress can fix that. And the other one is pretty simple as well. There's a chapter on something called pharmacy benefit managers, which may also sound strange to a lot of your listeners, but it's sort of the middle group that's formed since the 1980s in the pharmaceutical supply chain. These are big companies, Medco, PCS, Caremark, the multi-billion dollar companies. And all they do is they process the claims between the drug companies and insurance policies. They make the formularies, which many of your readers, listeners will have in terms of an insurance policy. You go out and a drug's either covered on the formulary or it's not. It's class one, class two. You pay a little bit more the lower the class is. And that's all created by these PBMs, as they're called. They get rebates from the drug companies in order to put the drugs on the formulary. So the drugs you get to choose from aren't necessarily the best or the cheapest. It's the one they're getting the biggest rebate on. And believe it or not, there's no law that requires those rebates to be transparent. So no one knows what they get, including the pharmacist who's filling the prescription for you. That was a simple fix. You could get an executive order from George Bush, Barack Obama, or Donald Trump. Any one of them could issue an order that says, those are going to be transparent. I want to know what they are. And I'll tell you, the price of a lot of drugs would drop overnight. Why it's not happening, I can't figure it out. But there are some ways forward that would not be that difficult.
You know, it certainly seems that there is a study done. I forget what university it was, Yale or one of those prestigious
right.
institutions that figured out that regardless that it doesn't matter what the people of this country want, if those who are in charge and those who have the money and influence don't want it, then it simply doesn't happen. You know, we're seeing that right now, particularly like there's definitely a rose in every thorn, and it seems like the collateral benefit of this current crisis is that the medical system, the Center for Disease Control, all of these institutions, and of course the medical industry and pharmaceutical industry are being. You know, things are being made more transparent. So what do you see perhaps some of the positive things coming out of this particular crisis that we're in now?
So if the pharmaceutical industry handles it right, and what I mean by right is there are 24, 26 firms, I think the last time I checked, that are in the race for the vaccine, from Johnson & Johnson, big ones, to small little biotechs in France, Israel, and Germany. If the companies that do a partnership on that eventually decide to share the research with one another, they don't nationalize the drug, which means if Chinese scientists come up with it first, they don't say, oh, we're going to inoculate just people in China before we save anyone else in the world. If we come up with it in the U.S., it's not, you know, we'll first give it to Americans and worry about people in, you know, South Africa or France or Italy later. It has to be shared research where drug companies around the world can start producing it. It's going to need a ton of manufacturing. If the prices are kept low, the product works, and the treatments they develop are not priced too high, drug industry can rehabilitate its reputation. That reputation I talked about before that's so low, in the 1950s, it may be hard for people, you know, who are born in the last 20 or 30 years to imagine that the drug industry was once one of the most respected in America. In the 1950s, after they came out of World War II and it invented penicillin, and we were at the cusp of science, of a new era where we thought science could cure everything. We might come up with the cures for all types of things. Color television was out, and pharmacy, and penicillin was out. The pharmaceutical industry was ranked as the top five or six all the time in those polls for nearly a decade. They started to lose it in the 60s a little bit, and then in the 70s when we found out that companies like Wyeth and others had hid the dangers of contraceptive pills and hormones for women on menopause, then they really started to go downhill. So I think this is a chance where suddenly we could say, okay, you know, they can come above it. We need them for life and death. Sometimes when a microbe is out that's new to the human race and we have no immunity for it, and they did it the right way, they shared the research, they didn't gouge us, and it could be fantastic for them and for us. I don't know if that will happen, but I hope so.
Well, I think that one of the things I think of people being sequestered in place right now, it's kind of a hit pause and a time for reflection. And, you know, again, the skies are clearing because we're not flying as much. All of these things that we have such a big footprint as a species, and technology is far, far, far outstripped wisdom, whether you call it spiritual wisdom or simply wisdom. And so this may be an opportunity for people, even if they can't gather in groups on the outer net, perhaps people can gather in groups on the internet and begin to talk about how ordinary people can begin to leverage some of these conditions, which incidentally, you know, we're talking about the 1950s. In the early, late 50s, early 60s, the early part of the late Eisenhower years and the Kennedy years, trust in government was something like 80%. 80%. Now it's something under 10%. You know, what's wrong with this picture? And I find it really interesting. This is kind of a sidetrack, but it's something that's happened this week. I know you wrote a book about the Kennedy assassination. All of a sudden, in the midst of this apocalyptic world situation, apocalypse meaning the lifting of the veils, Bob Dylan comes out with the song Murder Most Foul. Have you heard that song?
I have indeed heard it. I've heard almost 17 minutes of it.
Yeah, it's a lot of minutes of that. Any take on that as being, you know, as somebody who was just a young person, a teenager when Kennedy was assassinated, it has cast a shadow on everything that's happened in the last 55 years.
Absolutely. Steve, I think in some ways the Kennedy assassination was the start of this decline in public trust for the government. So you had the Kennedy assassination, this lack of belief in, you know, the official panel put up by the Warren Commission. Then you had the war in Vietnam, and we knew they were lying to us about the numbers of Viet Cong killed. If the numbers were right, they would have killed half the country time and time again. The light at the end of the tunnel from Westmoreland, no one believed it. And then we learned that not only did they lie to us about Vietnam, but Iran-Contra came out. We saw that time and time again, the government was willing to do things from Watergate on that was against the public interest. So I think that people did lose faith in those institutions. And what you talked about before, the fact that we've become so tribal means that although people are in their corners rooting for their side versus the other side, they forget that the real side is each other, that if we don't get in this in a joint way and we stand on the side just yelling at each other, that we'll be frozen, that nothing will get accomplished. And I think that's unfortunate because that loss of faith in government and government's not always the answer, that's for sure, but it does make things more difficult because people don't think they can come to help at all. Maybe this will change the perception a little if they can help on COVID-19.
You know, the thing is, if we go back to the 70s and the Powell Memorandum and, you know, Lewis Powell, who had, was a tobacco industry attorney, you know the story, I'm sure.
Right.
And that basically he began to warn all of the industries, hey, if we don't watch out, we're going to be regulated. And so they developed this entire mythology, which is typified by the Reagan administration, which is, you know, government bad, government bad, government bad. But in terms of the kinds of protections that people require, go back to the preamble to the Constitution for our republic. It says essentially that the government is here to not just you know, protect us from external enemies, but to promote general welfare, to promote, to be kind of a facilitator for our lives. And indeed, you know, you talk about NIH developing that drug. That was public service. We talk about the interstate highway system being developed. That was infrastructure that all of the industries that really want to externalize their costs, you know, they're benefiting from all of that. So I think part of what's happened is that there's been a mythology that government is bad, when actually government was simply designed as republic means thing of the people. So it's meant to be for us and not necessarily for those special interests.
Yeah, it's a very good point, by the way. You know, I must say that when you say that, the government since the 1930s, NIH has spent $930 billion. It's one of the statistics I remember from this on public research since the 1930s, and most of which has been taken by pharma companies and turned into drugs. And you're right about Reagan. When he came into office, one of the things he did was cut budgets across the board for government agencies, including the FDA and the CDC, unfortunately leading right into HIV and AIDS. So you're not a good time to have smaller staffs. We want the benefits of government service, but we don't want to pay for them. So it's an unusual mix.
So that, yeah, it's very, very true. So tell me more about what you're – obviously you've been on – I've seen you on a number of shows currently because the current crisis is in the news. Is there anything else you can say about how you see things moving forward from this crisis?
Well, I think that so we talked before about what's the good possibility, which is that we get some treatments in terms of antivirals to help prevent people from dying with COVID-19, and we come up with a vaccine in record time in a year and a half. It's all priced well, and everybody's in love with pharma again for a while. Or the bad case scenario is they stumble on a vaccine, which is not their fault, but it's possible. You know, it's been since the 1980s, they've been looking for a vaccine on HIV and AIDS. They can't get one. It's hard. Viruses are difficult sometimes. These aren't easy things. They only came up with a vaccine for Ebola last year, and that was, you know, found in the 1970s. So these can be slow processes. If the vaccine hunt was slow, if pharma stumbled on the drugs, then I think they take the blame, even though it's really nature. Look, I have a lot of respect for the microbes. I've learned that over time. It's Darwinian. It's survival of the fittest. And you have bacteria and you have viruses that are only trying to replicate and live. They get into our system and they use us as the host. We're trying to eliminate them so we don't die. And it's a battle taking place with this little invisible creature. So the worst case scenario is that the drug industry can't do the magic that we hope they can. Then we're all in trouble.
Well, you know, we haven't talked about because it really hasn't been time is the overprescription of antibiotics, as a matter of fact, the use of antibiotics in animals, so that we've developed so that the antibiotics get a jump on us, and there have been other side effects. including early puberty and all kinds of stuff.
You are so right. We could talk about that. I know we're near the end, but I just want to say to you, that's the reason that the infectious disease doctors I spoke to were so worried about the next pandemic, because they thought it would be bacterial. We've built up so much antibiotic resistance from over-dispensing it and from so much in the food supply. And the chapter, you know, my first chapter is called Patient Zero, about a woman who died in Reno, not that far away from you in Santa Rosa, the adjoining state over to the east. In 2016, she had a bacterial infection and no antibiotic worked to cure her, the first such patient to die. So we are, in the future, in trouble on that, no doubt.
And then the other thing, again, in the last minute and a half we have, you know, one of the things that I've noticed is that the pharmaceutical industry, through their lobbyists and influence, have tried to really squash alternative measures that actually build health. They're harmless. And if you look at Wikipedia, it's riddled with these debunking. In fact, I tried to Google somebody who recommended vitamin C, and all of the things that come up first in Google are all of the debunkers.
Very interesting. Oh, yeah. I didn't realize that, because there's no doubt that they have worked very, very hard to make sure that alternative therapies, medications, things that might work are considered, oh, God, that's ridiculous. Don't even think about that. You know, we've got a drug for that. Don't think you can get away with that by doing something else. You want to treat pain with acupuncture and therapy and stretching? Oh, come on. Forget about that. We've got opioids. I understand that would make sense that they would try to have the debunkers up front to try to push away any idea of a natural remedy that might work.
You know, and in fact, I'll send you an article about the research done on vitamin C, and that Facebook was instructed by the World Health Organization to cut off anybody who is promoting vitamin C as a remedy.
Amazing. Linus Pauling and his heirs. Yeah. All right.
He's flipping in his crypt. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much,
thank
Gerald
you,
Posner, being my guest today on WikiPolitiki. Gerald Posner, if you go to our site, wikipolitiki.com, you'll have a link to his website and his book, which is called Pharma. Oh, it's got a great subtitle, The Greed, Lies, and Poisoning of America. Folks, don't take it poisonally. We'll see you next week.